continuing from where we left last time. The conclusion that we drew was that the basic reality of ourselves is consciousness. Inasmuch as its characteristic precludes any division within itself, precludes also the existence of anything that is outside itself, it follows that consciousness should be universal in its nature. That is to say, it is all pervading. And there is no point in space where it is not. It has to be so. Because if it were not so, if there had been an internal variety in consciousness or an external division or relationship of any kind, there would be nobody to know that there is such a division inside or outside, because the knower is consciousness only. If consciousness has a division within it, if it is partite, if there is one part of consciousness differentiated from another part, if there is some gap between two parts which is not consciousness, who will be able to know that there is such a gap? Consciousness alone can know that there is a division within itself. The consciousness of there being such a gap between its own two parts would imply its presence even in the gap itself. The gap gets abolished. So is the case with external relation. There is no internal division and external relation to consciousness. It just is. We defined it as Sat. Pure Sat, pure existence, pure being. And it is aware of itself, therefore we call it Sat Chit. And as much as it is utter freedom from trammels of every kind, it is Ananda, bliss, the supreme reality, therefore is Sat Chit Ananda. It is not some particular location, it is not a thing, it is not a person, it is a definition of that ubiquitous absolute being. If this is the nature of reality, how is it that we are seeing something in the form of a world outside, as if there is a division between the seer and the seen? Our philosophical or analytical conclusion is that in conscious perception, there should not be a division. Consciousness cannot become an object of its own self. Nor can there be an object outside itself. Such being the case, how are we to explain this world experience? This seems to be a contradiction of the nature of ultimate being. Because of this contradiction between the nature of ultimate reality and our practical day-to-day experience, we call our experience as samsara, or involvement in something that is not real. Our perceptions contradict reality. In what way do they contradict? The knowledge of this situation requires a little bit of the insight of the nature of creation itself. How the world came to be. If we know the process of the creation of the universe, which includes creation of our own selves also, we will know to some extent where we stand in this world. Otherwise, we seem to be under the puerile impression, like children, that we are well off here on the surface of the earth in some locality, in some country, in some family, in some little cottage. This is the idea of our location as far as people like us are concerned. Are we really located in such a prosaic manner as we seem to define ourselves? In this structure of creation, can we say our location is a hut, a little bungalow, a little land? There seems to be something more about it than appears on the surface. There is a fundamental error in the process of human perception or any kind of empirical perception. In the process of creation, what is supposed to have taken place is a sudden split as it appears to take place in the dream world. You have become the seer as well as the seen in dream. Now we are in a state of waking. Our mind is integrated, we may say, because we have a total psychic operation. That is why we are sane, logical, sensible and intelligible. When we say our mind is perfectly in order, what we seem to mean is that there is no gap or split in the operation of the psyche. There is a perfect alignment of the parts of the psyche. So that the psyche, our mind, becomes a wholesome, integrated operation. This psyche of ours, which is so wholesome in waking, appears to become something other than what it is in the dream world. It can appear as a large mountain in front, space, time and what not. Who is the seer of the dream? The very same mind which has become the object. It also manufactures the process of perception like space and time. It is not just the segregation of the waking mind into the subjective side and the objective side. There is a third element of the possibility of perception of the objective world. There must be a connection between me and the object outside so that I may be aware that there is an object outside. This is very important. If the wall is in front of me, I must be able to know that there is a wall in front of me. How could I know it unless there is some kind of intelligible relation between me, between the so-called seeing mind and the object outside? The wall is not sitting inside my eyes. It is far away. How do I know that it is there? It has not jumped on my head. I can see even distant things without their being inside my eyes. This is a part of perceptional psychology. How do people perceive things? Mostly, the study of general psychology does not go deep into this matter. They do not wish to be philosophical in their nature. Psychology is not philosophy. Though in India especially, philosophy and psychology were related to each other as inseparables. Philosophy, religion and psychology in India especially go together. But in the West they have been isolated. Religion is different from philosophy, philosophy is different from psychology. And even in psychology we have general psychology, abnormal psychology, industrial psychology, experimental psychology, all sorts of things. Let it be. The psychology of perception has an implication behind it, within it, namely the intelligibility involved in the perception of an object outside. In dream, let us take this as a very clear example before us. How do we perceive the objective world of the dream world? You will be surprised to realize that this waking mind, so-called, which is our true mind, has manufactured a peculiar dramatic circumstance in the dream world, where it is the director of the drama. It is also the audience. It is the enacting process. It is also the light in the stage. If the light is not in the stage, there will be no performance intelligible. That light is something which people do not notice, though without which no perception is possible. When you are observing a dramatic performance, you are not going on looking at the light there. Though you know very well, without the light, nothing is possible. You are totally unaware of there being such a thing called light or a lamp. You are absorbed in the objective enactment and not in the condition that is precedent to the very enactment itself, namely light. So in the dream world as it is the waking world, we are so much involved in the object outside, engrossed in the value that we attach to that object or the meaning that we seem to be seeing there, so much engrossed that we have no time to go deeper into the very condition of this perception. How did this perception become possible at all? The mind has become the subjective side. It has become the object of perception. It has also become the intelligence connecting the subject with the object. This analogy of the dream phenomena will be a kind of explanation of what must have taken place or what has taken place, as scriptures tell us, when creation took place. We may compare our waking mind to a total absolute. For all our daily practical purposes, it is that. That totality of the absolute psyche of our waking condition has become the subjective side, the objective side, and the interlink between the subject and the object also. Now, in a cosmical fashion, the same thing has taken place. Analogically, we may transfer our dream perception psychology to the cosmic psychology of universal perception. If we are to study this subject in terms of the statements of the scriptures, especially in the Vedas and Upanishads, we will gather that there was the impulse to divide, as the waking mind has an impulse to become an object in the dream world, whatever be the cause. Into that subject we won't enter now. Why dreams take place is a different subject. The impulse to divide an organic totality into the subjective and the objective side is the cause of the dream perception. This total cosmic impulse is, according to scriptures, is the will of God. Let there be this, and it is there immediately by the very affirmation of the will. May I become other than what I am? The universe is the otherness of God, the self-alienation of the Absolute, the Supreme Being beholding itself as it were through the mirror of space and time. Place a mirror in front of you. Do you see yourself? Is it possible for a person to see one's own self? Can you become an object of your own self in perception? You know very well, in logical parlance, A cannot become B. A is A, this is the law of identity. And A cannot be B, law of contradiction. You cannot be something which is seen, because you are the seer. But in the mirror, you can see yourself. You have objectified yourself through a medium that makes it possible for you to behold yourself as an other than yourself. Have you really become other than yourself? No. Remove the mirror, the object is not there. The mirror of cosmic perception is space-time cause complex. Space is the name that we give to that intermediary vacuum or emptiness, as it were, which is necessary for alienating the subject into the object. Even in dream, a space is necessary. The dream space is absolutely essential, otherwise you will not see anything there. The space-time complex is the medium, it is the mirror through which the seeing mind beholds itself as if it is another. So God willed as if He is another. In the Purusha Sukta of the Veda, which we hear being chanted in the temple every day, and in certain other analogous mantras of the Vedas, enunciation is made that all this universe of variety are the limbs of the Absolute. The Purusha Sukta begins as Sahasra Shirsha Purusha Sahasra Aksha Sahasra Path Sabhumim Vishvato Vritva Atyatishthad Dashangula. Million-fold variety that is apparently visible as this universe are the heads and the eyes and the hands and the feet, the limbs of the Supreme Being as it were. And the Bhagavad Gita tells the same thing in its 13th chapter, Sarvada Panipadam Tat Sarvada Ochishuromukam. Sarvada Ochishuromukam. Sarvada Shrutimalloki Sarvam Avrati Dushtad. Everywhere ears, everywhere eyes, everywhere feet, everywhere heads, limbs of God. The idea is, in the dream world, the whole thing is mind. The mountain is the mind, the trees are the mind, the sun and the moon and the stars that you see in the dream world are your mind. The space is the mind, the time is the mind, the causal relation is the mind. The entire activity is the mind. In dream you see a tiger pursuing you and you run and climb the top of the tree. The tiger is your mind. The running process is the mind. The tree is your mind. Even the climbing is the mind. All this mysterious activity that you can see. You can become a butterfly in dream. You can become a king. You can become a pauper. You can even be born and die in dream. All these things, wondrous as they appear, are the dramatic activity, peculiar magical performance, as it were, of your mind. So this is again an analogy from our own personal experience to understand what the Veda means by saying that whole universe is God's limbs spread out, as it were. But has God really become something other than what He is? Has God become non-God merely because you see something as the form of creation? The answer to this question is, have you become the mountain really? If that is the case, you would not wake up into the person that you were. Mountain will wake up. There is no mountain. It has gone into the integrated mind. Though the dream world is there, really perceptible, and in dream you can hit your head against a real wall, yet nothing has happened. There are varieties of creation theories. The majority concluding that the world has somehow come from God. But this somehow is difficult to explain. The creationist doctrines of a realistic nature say that there is an actual modification of the reality into the form of this world. What do you mean by modification? As milk becomes curd or yogurt. When milk becomes curd, milk has ceased to be what it is. It has become the world of curds. It has ceased to be what it is. If that is the case, matter is very serious. There will be no milk. You cannot get milk afterwards. You can drink your curd, but you will not ask for milk again. If God has really modified Himself into this yogurt of the world, then there is no use asking for God, because God has ceased to be. He has become this which you are seeing with your eyes. That is a very dangerous doctrine. Looks like that because there is nothing to aspire for. All that you are aspiring for has died into this form of the manifested world. This doctrine is called Parinamavada, or the doctrine of transformation. Our aspirations do not permit this kind of argument of the realistic doctrines. We long for higher and higher things. We long for endless things. We long for eternal life. We do not want to die, we want to defy death. We would like to possess the entire space. We would like to overcome time itself. How does this aspiration arise in us if the root of it has ceased to exist? The analogy once again comes to our aid. Creation seems to have taken place, and very realistically indeed, but not as milk becoming curd, as an appearance. Is not the dream an appearance? Or has the mind really become the stone and the brick and the forest and the trees that you see in dream? In spite of the hard realistic perception of the dream world, it is psychic in its content. All the objects in the world of dream are psychic in their nature, they are not physical. In a similar manner, the entire world of perception, physical as it may appear in an astronomical sense, is a modification of consciousness. You may call it condensation, centralization, pinpointing, etc., etc., of the universal consciousness itself. It has become the seer of this world, the world that is seen, and also the process of perception. In the same way as the dream world has manifested itself from our own waking mind. Now, what happens to us in the dream world? We take it for real. We can get frightened in dream, we can feel happy in dream. All the experiences that we seem to be undergoing in the waking world also can be undergone in the dream world. If a tiger pounces on us in dream, we may scream, and the screaming may be real. We will yell up and get up, a tiger has come. Such reality is attributed to the object of pure psychic content. We get attached to things, and also we are repelled by things in dream world also. We can become emperors, we can become beggars in dream. There is a story that there was a king called Janaka of hallowed memory, whose name you must have heard. He dreamt one day that he was a butterfly. And the intensity of the feeling that he was a butterfly was such that when he woke up, he did not know whether he was King Janaka or butterfly dreaming that it is king. He asked Yajnavalkya, "Am I butterfly?" He said, "Your Highness, you are Emperor Janaka." No, I was butterfly. "You know, you are dreaming. Is it so? Is Janaka dreaming that he is butterfly? Is butterfly dreaming that he is Janaka? Either way, it can be. Now, what do you say for this?" Humorously, someone said, if a poor person can dream for 12 hours that he is a king, and if a king can dream for 12 hours that he is a beggar, what is the difference between these two persons? Because for 12 hours, both are king or beggar. Who is the king? Who is the beggar? Tell me. Because for 12 hours, the king is the beggar, and for 12 hours, the beggar is the king. Now, what do you understand from this analogy? This is the mystery of psychic phenomena. You may call it a jugglery. We call it a jugglery, we have to call it so, because if really God has become this world, there is no use our asking for God realization. Yes, it used to be, but that cannot be. We ourselves are a standing witness of the refutation of the doctrine of God having died into the form of this modified world. Our attachments, our aversions, our loves and hatreds, our grabbing habit of property, even our love for life and fear of death can be bundled up into a single phenomenon of utter confusion in the mind. Because if that had not been a muddle up of our psychic operation, making us believe that it is absolutely real. Don't you cry and weep sometimes when you see a picture that is projected on a screen? You will not sleep sometimes after having seen certain pictures. You will be elated, you will be jumping in joy, or you will cry. What have you seen there? There was nothing actually speaking. It was a shadow dance. The shadow dance was three-dimensionally projected into the structure of the mind with such vehemency that you take it for reality and then you weep or jump in joy. For us to be happy or unhappy, objects need not necessarily be there really. Even if non-existent things can make us happy and unhappy, provided our mind is connected to it. Suppose an old mother's son is serving in the army in a foreign country. For years he has not come back. He is perfectly well. Some false news reaches her that the son is dead in a battlefield. The mother can die of heart attack and collapse. My only son is gone. Really nothing has taken place. An unreal phenomenon can kill a lady. But suppose he is really dead and for 10 years no news comes. He is perfectly all right. So, what is the cause of your sorrow? Something really happening or your mental operation? This is the reason why yoga psychology tells us be careful in your emotions, in your perceptions, in your loves, in your hatreds, in your taking things so realistically, seriously, that you die for it. Things are not to be taken so seriously in terms of emotion. Yoga psychology also distinguishes between ordinary psychic perception and what you call abnormal psychic perception. This is incidental to our studies, but important. When we look at a thing, we may look at it in two ways. As just an object which is there, or an object that is connected with us. Are you not seeing a tree there in front of you? What concern have you got with that tree? You pass by it 100 times every day, you don't even recognize its existence there. Suppose there are trees in your own garden around your house, you will go on seeing every leaf of it. How beautiful is this flower? How tender is this leaf? This is the tree that my grandfather planted. Here is the orchard. But there are so many trees in the forest. Nobody bothers about them. Some fall down. Some are withered away. Some are cut. Suppose somebody cuts your tree in the garden. Now, why this difference? This difference is the subject of what generally is called abnormal psychology, where emotions are connected. Raga and dvesha, like and dislike, are connected with one kind of mental operation, where in others, it is a general consciousness of something being there in front. If your emotions are disturbed or stimulated in any way, that is something quite different from ordinary perception. You sit in a railway compartment and you see hundreds of people sitting there. You don't bother to know who is sitting there. They are like things, not human beings. You will get in and you will go out, let them come, let them go, what are you concerned about? But suppose it is a marriage party of your own group, everyone is known to you. And anything happening to anyone is happening to you also. What is the difference? Are the other passengers are not human beings? Only your marriage group is human being. Can you say that? See the wonder of the working of the mind. Inasmuch as all experience in this world is mental finally, a yoga student should be very cautious and not get involved too much in objects of perception to such an extent that it may ruin your health, spoil your career, and disturb your normal relationship with it. In order that your normal relationship internally as well as externally be always normal and does not land yourself in any kind of abnormal situation, the yoga psychology prescribes the well-known disciplines of what are known as yamas. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha, yama. They are disciplines connected with internal alignment as well as external relation of a harmonious nature. It is an imposition upon you by a mandate of a characteristic that is moral or ethical. Are we to become disciplined and good only because there is a policeman outside? Or can we be good and disciplined even if there is no government? Somebody should hit you on the head so that you may become good. The yamas and niyamas as they are like policemen. They compel you, you must be like this. But that kind of morality is not going to help us much. The thief who does not carry on his profession because of policemen around does not cease to be a thief. He is a thief nevertheless. Even if gold is heaped in front of you and nobody sees you, if your mind is not disturbed by its presence, you are not a thief. So your morality or ethics or your goodness of behavior or your detachment so called should not be there because the scripture says or the institution penalizes or you are afraid of God himself. He will put you in hell if you don't do that. You must realize it is always good to be good. Why is it good to be good? What is the harm if I am not good? You cannot have a real answer to this question immediately. children in the schools who are taught given moral lessons may put a question, "Sir, that man is so bad and he is thriving very well. Why are you telling me to be good?" The teacher sometimes cannot immediately give an answer to this question. The evil man thrives and the good man goes to hell. What is this? And you tell me to be good. The children in the kindergarten school can put a question like this. Why kindergarten? We ourselves may feel that. Elderly people. We get upset, irritated by saying things. That is, our behavior seems to be conditioned by certain disciplines imposed upon us. Yoga discipline is not imposition. Meditation is not an exercise. Like physical games, it is a demand of your inner nature itself. You have to find an answer to your own self as to why it is good to be good. Why it is not good to be attached to things. Don't you feel happy if you are attached to lovable objects? Certainly. But yet you are told you should not get attached to anything even if it looks lovable and attractive. Why? You answer the question yourself. Something beautiful, attractive and lovable, you say don't get attached to it. There is sense in your instruction. It will be revolt from inside. The scriptural instructions and the guru's orders, whatever they be, will create a revolt inside the student's mind when he is told something contrary to what he feels inside. Now, why does he feel in some way totally different from what is told to him to be good? Spiritual practice is an inner demand and not an external imposition. It is not because somebody says, somebody is sitting in meditation, let me also sit. You feel a need for it for some reason of your own. You are a good man because you know what is the meaning of a good man. You are a gentleman, you know what is the meaning of it. Are you a gentleman because it is good to be a gentleman in the eyes of people? Is it a social psychology? Is goodness a social characteristic or a personal requirement? Deep students and teachers of moral science tell us that goodness is good not because it brings some benefit to you, because the goodness itself is a benefit. It is difficult to understand this. What is the benefit if I am just good? Answer to this cannot come immediately because the relationship of yours to the whole universal structure is not clear to the mind. You must first of all know what is the meaning of being good. Swami Shivananda Maharaj always says, be good, do good. But tell me, what do you mean by being good? Have some idea in your mind. It is a gradational adjustment of your own existence with the structure of reality outside. It is a very pithy sutra-like statement that I have made. An adjustment of your total being with the various degrees of reality manifest before you, including all the environment up to the cosmos. So from the study of the process of creation, which seems to be involving a peculiar split of the subjective side and the objective side in an otherwise total cosmic existence, what we learn is that empirical perception, sensory perception, or the affirmation of the ordinary psychic operations and the egoistic nature are not normal, finally, in their real sense. Very honestly, if we speak for our own selves, it will mean none of us is ultimately normal. From a purely spiritual and philosophical sense. If normalcy is to be defined as perfect harmony with the structure of things, and who is in such harmony with the structure of things? We are always dissonant. There is repulsion and fear, agony, anxiety, and expectation of anything arising on account of the continuous non-alignment of the inner operation of the mind with external manifestation. The mind in dream that sees the dream world is not set in tune with the object of dream. That is why in dream also you can have joy and sorrow. But if the dream mind was to know that it is itself appearing as the object outside, there will be neither joy nor sorrow. Why is it that we are told saints and sages have neither sorrow nor joy in their mind? They are not dead people. They are fully aware of all things. But their awareness is so tuned up to the nature of things that nothing affects them, either positively as love or negatively as hatred. In the structure of this creational process, we are now placed in the position of a percipient, a seer of this world, you and I, everybody, and we behold a vast phenomenon of space, time and objects. Yet, there is an invisible content pervading this process of perception. Between me and you, there is an intermediary intelligence pervading everywhere, which we cannot see, because it is the seer. If the dream percipient were to be perceiving also the intelligence between itself and the object, there will be no dream. The dream will vanish in 1 second. It is necessary not to know certain things in order that you may enjoy a false performance, like a cinema for instance. You go on thinking it is after all a shadow and it is a screen, you will not enjoy the picture. If we are to be conscious of that which is operating between ourselves and the world outside, something between us, between me and you here, which looks like empty space, if one is to be conscious of that, the perception of an object will cease in 1 second. The world perception will vanish. In our studies of this cosmic process of creation, we come across certain words like Adhyatma, Adhibhuta and Adhidaiva. The subjective side is called Adhyatma, the objective side is called Adhibhuta. That invisible content between the subject and the object is called Adhidaiva, the divine principle superintending over all kinds of perception by the subject of the object. The central thing involved in all perception is this intermediary link called Adhidaiva. They are called gods. In India we worship many gods. Are there many gods really speaking? Yes and no. There is only one God, perfectly correct. Because we have concluded the ultimate being should be universal undividedness of consciousness. Therefore, there cannot be more than one God. But why are you worshipping so many gods? This series of the many gods is nothing but the intermediary link of consciousness between various stages of the connection between subject and object in the process of coming and going. There are various stages of the descent of the absolute into this perceptional world of physicality. These stages are sometimes called the realms of being, or in our own Sanskrit style we say bhuvan or lok, bhuvok, bhuvarlok, swarlok, maharlok, janalok, tapolok, satyalok. What do you mean by all these things? They are inner contents of the perceived world. What is it? You may ask me. What do you mean? I will give you an example as what this could be. What the inner content of a thing can be. Bring a big object like a stone. Inside the stone, there are molecules. Inside the molecules, there are atoms. Inside the atoms, there are finer contents, electrons, whatever you call. Inside them, there is something mysterious. Like that, there are seven stages of invertization of the structure of a particular thing. This invertization of the content of the whole world in seven stages, call them invertization in the ascending order or externalization in the descending order, are these worlds cosmically Sanskritized names: bhulok, bhuvarlok, swarlok, janalok, tapolok, satyalok. Now, in every lok, in every world, in every realm of this internalization of the cosmos, there is subject-object relation. And in every subject-object relation, there is an intermediary intelligence. That is what we call the God. And as there are countless relationships of subject and object, you can say millions of gods also are there. So don't say Hinduism has many gods. It is nothing of the kind. It is a way of perceiving things, an interpretation of the various process of the coming and going of things. So, is what is the meaning of Adhyatma, Adhibhuta, Adhideva? Adhyatma is the perceiver in any realm, in any stage of ascent or descent. Adhibhuta is the object in any stage of ascent or descent. Adhideva is the God in this ascent and descent. So you have got three things. The very clear existence of the percipient like you, me. The very clear existence of an object like the wall or a building or a mountain, which is also very clear. The imperceptible divinity which is superintending over both the subject and the object. Very, very important thing, which we always miss in our observation, which is the cause of our trouble in this world. If you can transfer our consciousness, which is perceiving, into the intermediary, transcendent element between the seer and the seen, you would become a superman in one instant. Hari Om Tat Sat.